This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the U.S. has been trying to overthrow the leftist government in Venezuela ever since it was voted into power back in 1998. But President Trump is threatening to use direct American military force. The Syrian so-called white helmets are treated like Hollywood heroes, but they're really Al-Qaeda terrorists, subsidized and protected by Britain and the U.S. And Mumia Abu-Jamal reviews a book about black communists organizing in Alabama in the 1930s.
But first, folks on the left have a lot to say about the pros and cons of Democrats like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the young woman that won an upset congressional victory against a machine Democrat in New York City. But Black Agenda Report managing editor Bruce Dixon says the activists should concentrate on improving their own organizational skills if they want to serve the people effectively.
I wrote two Ocasio articles, I think, before this. And I think I actually stayed away from much intense criticism of the lady's actual policies and programs and stands on issues. First article, what I wrote is that now that she's won, she's going to be subject to institutional and social pressures, and that elected officialdom in the United States is an institution. You go through a door every time you go onto the floor of where you vote, and nobody else can come through that door except other elected officials and former elected officials who are all lobbyists. There's 100 people whispering in your ear, and all of them are lobbyists and people in the service of capital. You know, what we have in the United States, I mean, we learn in school that there are countries that have one-party systems, and they're supposed to be bad for that. And you have to belong to that one party to be any part of the government. But what we seem not to get is that here in the United States, we've got a two-party system where we have just two government parties instead of one. And that's really the only difference. So Ocasio, I wrote, would be subject to all these pressures, and the left has no institutional means of reining in candidates like this. I helped elect a dozen or more such candidates in Chicago in my years there, and the left elected quite a few more than that in the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s, and we had no control over them. A few stayed and stayed the line, and most did not. Many got tired. Many sold out little by little. That's what I wrote the first time. You know, the second time it was a bit different. I actually talked about, you know, the numbers and the characteristics of the Ocasio win without really going into her positions on issues much. I left that to other people. There's plenty of people who want to talk about her positions on issues. And as the left, sometimes we have a tendency of talking too much about issues and not enough about the technical aspects of how this stuff gets done, how organizing gets done, how campaigns and elections get done, and how we carry on this work with each other and how we carry on the people's work. And that's what I tried to concentrate on in the third article, which I just laid down, that the Ocasio campaign, everybody nowadays says they're an organizer. Barack Obama was an organizer. People will tell you, well, yeah, I was waiting for the bus, so I went down there and I organized for a couple of hours among these people on the corner here. I've heard that. What the Ocasio interview on Daniel Denver's The Dig podcast did is Ocasio actually laid out a number, a figure that quantified the effort that her campaign made. They made 120,000 phone calls. And that's a benchmark. That's a benchmark. Is your organization making 1,000 phone calls a week, 2,000 phone calls a week? If you're not, what are you really organizing?
Well, is that a benchmark for you in the day-to-day work that you do in Georgia, where you're one of the leaders of the Georgia Green Party?
We haven't got to that level yet. There was one point where, as a matter of fact, we failed several times to climb that hump to get us up to the 5,000 calls a month place. We're estimating that to build a really sustainable party on a basis of membership dues, a minimum of, I'm thinking, 4,000 to 5,000 phone calls a month. That's what it's going to take. We're not there yet. And I would bet you that almost no green parties in the country are there yet. I think we're going to get there in 3 to 4 months, and it's what we're working toward. But it's a realistic goal, and it's a concrete goal, and it actually does what you need it to do. Everybody who says that they're an organizer ain't never been an organizer. I remember in the early 90s, I was a Democratic operative, although I'm denied that I was a Democrat. And one of the projects I was on in 1992 was the voter registration drive for Project Vote. Barack Obama was the fundraiser and executive director. I was one of the three lead organizers, along with Carol Harwell and Brian Banks. If you saw me, Carol, or Brian during that era, it was before cell phones, all day and half the night, we had a phone in each ear. We wound up registering to vote 133,000 people in 4 months and chasing them out to the polls and recruiting a sizable cohort of them to man 50, 60, 100, and 150 telephones in a telephone bank at Teamster City. How do you do that? You do that with thousands of phone calls, thousands. That's how you do it. You create a buzz and you create horizontal communication between people. That's organizing. And if your organizing efforts are not doing that, then you're not organizing. It's just that simple. You're just talking to other people about organizing or talking to other people about your political positions, which is fine and necessary, but it's only a part of the task here.
So what you're talking about here is not just Green Party organizing or electoral activity, but organizing in general. And so is there a critique here for people in other aspects of movement politics in terms of who's an organizer and who's that thing that folks call an activist?
That's the word I should have been using, is an activist versus an organizer. An activist is responsible to no one but herself or himself. An organizer, supposedly, is responsible to some body of people, and it's about trying to move some bodies of people, recruit some bodies of people. And yeah, that's why the title of the article didn't say electoral organizing. It just said organizing. This is something that you do outside of political campaigns, outside of electoral campaigns, is you create horizontal buzz among the people whom you're trying to get together to participate in attacking their problems and changing the world for the better.
So how much has the advent of the internet and this plethora of social media become a kind of crutch for would-be movement activists and organizers?
Wow, that is a big question and a big topic. And the person you want to interview about that is Jody Dean, who I bet you would say yes if you called her up on it. She's written a couple of books about that subject, about how the internet has harnessed a lot of activists into shouting at the void and doing things that might make them feel good, this online activism thing, but which are not really organizing anybody, but just creating more clicks and more wealth for the Googles of the world and the Mark Zuckerbergs of the world. Online dialogue and online stuff has its usefulness and its place, but when you get 100 more likes on your Facebook page, you don't even know who these people are. Facebook doesn't tell you who they are.
Well, let's examine that. You've held up a benchmark of 120,000 phone calls for a congressional campaign like Ocasio-Cortez registered. But what about the activist who says, well, I've got 120,000 followers on Twitter. I don't need to make 120,000 phone calls.
Well, you know, 50-some years ago, Marshall McLuhan wrote a book that said the medium is the message. And, you know, he was right as far as it goes. It's one thing to buy a candy bar for the wrapper, but it's quite another thing to buy the candy bar and then eat the wrapper and throw the candy away. You know, what you're describing is somebody who buys the candy bar, throws the candy away, and just eats the wrapper. Twitter and Facebook are like rivers. There's information going by, flowing by, and if you're not there when it flows by, you missed it, buddy. Try to find that concise tweet from 2 weeks ago. Try to find that insightful post on Facebook from last month. You can't find it. Their business model is generating new content, new clicks, and it's just not suited for real organizing. And once again, your Twitter followers, you don't know who they are. You cannot contact them outside of Twitter. You can't contact your Facebook likes outside of Facebook. In one of my Organizing 100 series done about 4 years ago around the time of Ferguson, I talked about how some young black women here in Atlanta organized a Ferguson protest. And they were chatting online, and one of them said, "Hey, is there going to be a demo on this Ferguson stuff?" And the other one said, "I don't know. Why don't you organize it?" And she did. She got on Facebook. She got on Twitter. And she railed it up and down. And in 4 or 5 days, they had a nice little thing where 200 or 300 people showed up. And so I asked her next. I said, "Hey, wow, did you get their phone numbers?" And she said, "No, we didn't." And there you go. So you put 200 or 300 people together with a week's part-time effort, and you can't contact them any other way but through Facebook again. That's, you know, kind of a wasted opportunity. If you got their phone numbers, you'd be able to call them on their schedule. You'd be able to deepen and widen these relationships instead of depending upon the capitalist media and the market to facilitate and moderate and mediate your interaction with what should be your people. That's what the left has to learn. Antonio Gramsci. I love some Antonio Gramsci. All leftists love them some Antonio Gramsci. And I reopened one of his books for the first time in years a couple of months ago. And what leapt off the page at me was not his talking about cultural hegemony and all the rest of that. What leapt off the page to me when I read Gramsci is that he was basically saying that implicit in his conversation, apparently every Italian town — Gramsci, by the way, was a leader of the Italian Communist Party who spent the last dozen years of his life locked up by Mussolini's jailers in a fascist prison where he died, but he was able to communicate from out of the prison. Anyway, what Gramsci was saying was that every Italian town of any size that had a Communist Party branch had its own newspaper, in every town. The left doesn't own its own means of communication, hardly. We don't have a lively internal discussion where we talk about our differences, where we educate each other, where we critically interrogate the things that we got to critically interrogate. We got to go on Facebook and depend on Google and Mark Zuckerberg to allow us to communicate. We've got a problem there, and we've got to really work on building institutions like Black Agenda Report and like many others that are able to communicate outside the matrix as much as possible and build our own independent, viable, critical conversations and analyses. And that's why we're working on improving Black Agenda Report. In the coming days, we're going to reinstate our indexes so that people can properly search our content. The last 12 years, you know, the left has to develop its own conversations outside of social media, and there are uses of social media too. What Ocasio said is that they used social media to contact and keep in contact with the people that they recruited in their doorways and on the streets. So they identified people first, got their phone numbers first, or at least got their emails, and then used social media. And by the way, email is social media too. But then they used social media to connect them. So they were not just shouting into the void. They were talking to a defined bunch of people. And when you've got a defined bunch of people, you can use Facebook and Twitter and SMS messages and even robocalls, although I'm not a big fan of robocalls, to talk to them. And the 120,000 phone calls, by the way, does not include robocalls.
And with the advent of Russiagate McCarthyism, the reliability of social media as platforms even for leftist discourse is now in deep question.
Yeah, well, everything's in deep question when they start calling you a Russian agent. As most people will know, Black Agenda Report was actually one of the very first news and commentary outlets labeled as being under the influence of the Russians back 2 Octobers ago. And we suffered we didn't have the money to hire consultants to get exact figures, but I would estimate as managing editor that we lost a good third of our traffic instantly because of that. And we are the only Black outlet so targeted that I know of, the only one. So we've got some work to do. Everybody's got some work to do. And this Russiagate thing is something that is going to come back and will be used against the left, especially the Black left. Your article detailing some of the perfidy of Sean King is an example. There are a lot of smaller Sean Kings out here, too, who are applying exactly that same route and selling that same upside-down madness. So our work is cut out for us.
And of course, Sean King has nothing to worry about, at least in the immediate term, in terms of having his algorithms tampered with.
Of course. He's a member of the establishment. He's one of the spokes Negroes that they put out there. He wants to be Rachel Maddow. Okay? That's what he wants to be. He's got his course. He's chosen his side. He knows what he wants to do, and we need to do our jobs.
There's a very interesting article in this week's Counterpunch by Richard Moser titled Post-Sanders Politics, Strategy, Sheepdogs, and Synergy. And first, I'd like to say that you are the person who gets credit for attaching the sheepdog label to Sanders. But this article says that there are valuable lessons that could have been learned, that can be learned, from the Bernie or Bust movement, which gathered 100,000 signatures from Bernie Sanders supporters who basically were saying that if Bernie didn't get the nomination, they would go for Jill Stein.
Yeah, I read the article as well. I haven't read the book that he's plugging, so I have to say that up front. I found some things to agree with and some things to disagree with in the Moser article. I really don't agree with his assessment of the Sanders campaign, which he characterizes the Sanders campaign as part of an inside-outside strategy. I don't think it was inside-outside. Sanders was not inside-outside. He kissed the slimy Democratic ring the day he started his campaign, saying that he would endorse the winner of the Democratic primary process, which everyone knew had to be Hillary Clinton. So Sanders was not an inside-outside. He was an inside-inside guy. And that's the essence of what a sheepdog does. A sheepdog drives people inside. For there to be an inside-outside strategy, there have to be forces working inside the Democratic Party, and there have to be forces working successfully outside it as well. Both of these things have to happen separately, but they both give energy to each other in a way. We have to recognize, as some other people have said, Adam Hilton, I guess, is one of the ones who said that we have to recognize, and he's DSA to the core, and so is Adam Proctor on his show Dead Pundits. They're all DSA guys to the core. They're wrong about a lot of things, but they're right about some things. One thing they're right about is that the Democratic Party is a government party and that it is a site of contestation, relevant contestation and struggle, just because so many of our people who we hope to win over are still there. And so we have to recognize that, and they have to recognize that we're legitimate outside that party, too. I don't see how anyone struggling for justice who imagines that they've got a place for that struggle still in the Democratic Party can't see that having a powerful left outside of the Democratic Party potentially pushes some of its stuff leftward. I don't understand how some of them can't see that, but it's a fact. For there to be an inside-outside strategy, both of those things have to happen, and there has to be a deal of critical and constructive dialogue between the people inside the Democratic Party and those operating outside it, like us Green. We have to find ways to do that.
Yes, but I think that is what Richard Moser is saying, that there has to be an ongoing conversation between left Bernie supporters and Green Party people and other folks on the left.
I did say I agreed with a lot. That's the part I agree with. The part I disagree with is that Sanders was inside-outside. Sanders wasn't inside-outside. He was the inside. And your Bernie-crats are insiders. But on the whole, I was surprised to find a lot to agree with there in that article. I mean, Moser even discounts the existence of the sheepdog phenomena, you know, which obviously I have to disagree with that because it just doesn't comport with the facts. But there was a lot positive in the article I was not expecting to see, really. But the thing of it is, like he says, there has to be constructive dialogue between us, and there has to be constructive dialogue among us. Inside the Green Party, we are working to build a kind of robust dialogue among Greens, which has not existed up to this point. Just like these people working in the Democratic Party have a lot to do, and ultimately, we don't think they'll be able to finish doing it in the Democratic Party, but they got a lot to do with what they're doing. We got a lot to do inside the Green Party. You know, we've got to take hold of this 25-year institution, well-intentioned and often clueless, mostly white liberals, in the 1990s. And it is a very, very imperfect vehicle for what we want to do with it, especially if we call ourselves socialists. But there are quite a number of avowed socialists who are in leadership of parts of the Green Party, and we are turning it. We are turning it. And in the coming months and couple of years, you're going to see a more explicitly socialist Green Party. That's coming. Get ready for it.
That was Bar Managing Editor Bruce Dixon speaking from Atlanta.
Mark Weisbrot is an economist and co-director of the Washington-based Center for Economic and Policy Research. The center intensely follows U.S. policy in Latin America. Mark Weisbrot hit on a novel way to critique U.S. behavior in Latin America since the turn of the 21st century. He wrote a totally fictional letter in which Thomas Shannon, a long-term U.S. diplomat in Latin America, gives advice to Mike Pompeo, President Trump's Secretary of State. Weisbrot's fictitious Ambassador Shannon tells Pompeo that Presidents Bush and Clinton carried out remarkably similar policies to undermine leftist governments in Venezuela, Brazil, Argentina, Bolivia, and elsewhere, and with much success.
Now, when you get to Trump, you do see one significant difference. He's put Marco Rubio in charge, and he is outside of the mainstream. And so he will say things that weren't said even by Bush administration officials. And not just say things. I mean, I think that financial embargo on Venezuela, for example, a significant change. That is, they're trying to strangle the economy, which is already in horrible shape even before that. And they're openly calling for a military coup, something I don't think the U.S. government has done, even going all the way back to the coup in Chile in 1973. They don't support a coup until after it happens. And they have an explicit goal of regime change. And so that's a significant difference in terms of Venezuela. In terms of the rest of the region, I don't know how different it really is. I mean, both the Obama and Bush administrations did take advantage of any opportunity to try and get rid of any of the left governments if they could.
Now, this retired diplomat, Thomas Shannon, whose persona you inhabit for the purposes of this letter, has had a career that spans 35 years, and he gives, or you give, Pompeo a real big picture of U.S. policy and experiences in Latin America during that time. And the 21st century, at least the last decade or so of it, looks a lot different for U.S. policy and U.S. policy prospects in Latin America than the 20th century has.
Well, yes. Actually, the first decade of the 21st century was the big one. There you had elections in Brazil, Argentina. Venezuela was just 2 years earlier in 98, but it was the one that kind of started it off. Ecuador, Bolivia, Uruguay, Paraguay, Honduras, El Salvador, Nicaragua. The majority of the region became governed through elections by left governments, something that nothing like that had ever happened before. So that is what both Bush and Obama were dealing with and trying to roll it back. And they did succeed in the weaker countries. They got rid of, you know, Bush overthrew the government of Haiti for the second time in 2004. And that effort actually did begin under Clinton in 2000. And then you had Honduras in 2009, where Hillary Clinton acknowledged in her 2014 book that she worked to make sure that the democratically elected president of Honduras could not return to office. And so they played a major role in that coup as well. And they also, under the Obama administration in 2012, there was a parliamentary coup in Paraguay, which they assisted in the consolidating that. But in the other countries, they weren't able to get very far, even though they were funding opposition groups in a number of countries, and of course, especially Venezuela. But they didn't get that far. And then things began to fall apart for the left, mainly in the second decade of the 21st century. And that's where, again, the U.S. government was able to take advantage of weakening economies and also the opposition that emerged from that, for example, in Brazil when they went into recession in 2014. And so the U.S. has supported those efforts to get rid of, where they could, the biggest left governments in the region, especially Brazil and Argentina. And that's where this letter comes in, because the author, the alleged author of this, is writing to Pompeo and said, look, the left took over this region for the first time ever in the first decade of the 20th century, and we got most of it back, so don't blow it. Don't be extremist. We did this through a lot of public diplomacy, which includes an occasional military coup, but nonetheless, a lot of very good public relations and a lot of effort with the media that was very successful, and he's telling them this is the way you do it. You don't do it by threatening military coups, using illegal financial embargoes, and so on.
Your Thomas Shannon, the personality that you assume, has a very triumphal tone in terms of U.S. foreign policy. Do you think the United States really feels that way, that they're on top or getting there, regaining their position of supremacy in Latin America?
Well, there's no doubt that they've gained in recent years. I mean, you have right-wing governments in Brazil, Argentina, Peru, Colombia. That is an example where Santos, the president who just stepped down, he actually had switched sides. And he had previously been with the Minister of Defense with Uribe, who was very closely allied to the United States. And then when he took office in 2010, the first thing he did was make peace with Venezuela and generally took the same side as the left governments on the hemispheric issues. And that's how powerful this change was. It really created whole new norms in the hemisphere for Latin American and Caribbean countries and institutions as well, UNASUR, the Union of South American Nations, the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States, which was like the OAS, but without the U.S. and Canada. So there was real change, and they've reversed a lot of it. Now, I don't agree at all that it's over. First of all, you can see this from the Mexican election a few weeks ago. I mean, this is something that's never happened in Mexico, and this is a left populist, and both he and his designated foreign minister, they said it affirmatively, they're going to support a policy of self-determination and non-interference in the hemisphere. And that's, you know, that's like hate speech to the United States government, and they don't like that at all. And that's really what they're always fighting against in all of these. You know, it isn't so much driven by particular corporate interests as it is the interest that this so-called national security state has in having everybody line up with them, everybody line up with their foreign policy and the regime in Haiti, which, as I said, they overthrew that government twice since 1991. And what does Haiti have? It doesn't have anything that they really want. They just want to make sure that they keep control over any government that is not strong enough to really be independent.
Yes, Mr. Obrador, the Mexican president-to-be, his election, and he is considered, well, too left for the United States' comfort. His country is not only a large country in its own right, but it's a neighbor of the United States, and his domestic policies, as well as his foreign policy, have ramifications for the United States, not just because it's a neighbor, but because so many Mexican Americans live here.
That's right. I think you will have conflict over immigration policy. It's kind of funny, you know, Trump has been friendly to him. He congratulated him even before the official results were in, and he was very friendly. And I think, I'm just guessing, but it looks like what happened is you had all this terrible coverage in the U.S., especially in the pundits and the opinion pieces, that just compared him to Trump, because that's their way of degrading him as a populist, and maybe some of them can't tell the difference. But I think what happened was Trump saw that everywhere and thought, well, maybe he's not so bad. And, of course, I mean, Mexico does have to try and get along with the U.S. He's not going to gratuitously provoke this government, but he is going to have conflict over immigration and over NAFTA renegotiation and a number of issues. But I think the part that's going to get buried in the press, because they just kind of assume that everyone is supposed to obey the United States on foreign policy, is that I think there's going to be a lot of conflict behind the scenes there, no matter what happens between Trump and Lopez Obrador. I think you're going to see, you already see it. You saw it in the campaign. You had people high up in the Trump administration saying very negative things about AMLO before he was elected. For example, in November, you had the election in Honduras, and it's the same party that the U.S. helped bring to power in 2009 after the military coup. In November, that election was stolen. I mean, it was so badly stolen that even the Secretary General of the Organization of American States, who has been the most pro-U.S. Secretary General for decades, said that it had to be rerun. And so Mexico came out and said, no, it's good. And they were the first ones to say that. And then the U.S. followed and then it said, oh, well, Mexico's endorsing this, so we will too. But it was reported in Reuters just 2 days later that the U.S. government actually went to the Mexican government, the current one, that is before AMLO was elected, and asked them to do that. So that's the kind of cooperation they had from the Mexican government, and it's very different from what Mexican foreign policy has been historically throughout most of the 20th century. So Mexico is now going to have a much more independent foreign policy, and that's the second largest country by population and economy in Latin America, and very important. I don't think they're going to play a leadership role like Venezuela or even Brazil or Ecuador or Bolivia did in the first decade of the 20th century in confronting the United States, but they're not going to be their tool either.
Your ambassador, Thomas Shannon, the person who you put words in his mouth, he didn't say much about China and Latin America. And yet a big part of the story of Latin America in the 21st century is the huge Chinese economic penetration.
Yeah, China is definitely, I mean, their trade and investment with and in Latin America has grown enormously in the 21st century, and it has played a role in the sense that it gives these countries more autonomy, and it makes them less vulnerable to pressure from the United States. Any kind of alternative source of capital will do that. And, you know, China has a different policy. I mean, they want certain things. They want the raw materials. They want to sell their products in the region, but they negotiate for that, and they don't intervene at all in the internal affairs of any of the countries. And they don't try to tell them what their internal macroeconomic policy should be, for example, which are two things that the United States has done repeatedly.
And your advice, that is your Thomas Shannon's advice to the Trump administration, is not to throw U.S. weight around too much in Latin America just because U.S. influence is on an upward curve.
That's right. He's urging them to use diplomacy, and especially what he calls public diplomacy, which includes a lot of media work and a lot of shaping the public debate in a way that softens what you were doing. Now, Bush wasn't so great at that. I mean, he was deeply unpopular in Latin America. And I think the support for the 2002 coup, for example, in Venezuela was part of that. But it was also, you know, Obama just had a whole different image in the media, world media entirely, for a whole set of reasons. And he was able to do the same things and not and still, because the media has such hegemony, it's worse in Latin America than it is here. You know, it's more like Fox News in most countries, only the majority of the media instead of one section of it. So he was able to do a lot better. But I think what the letter writer here is arguing is that in both administrations, they both tried and succeeded to varying degrees in containing the left as much as they could, and then rolling it back in the last few years before Trump took office, without these kinds of threats of military intervention, openly supporting, calling for military coups, and the kind of clumsiness that breeds real animosity.
And I have to ask you, would you hope that the real Secretary of State Pompeo would take the advice that's given in this letter?
Well, some of it, I mean, because I think some of these things are really worse. I mean, what they're doing to Venezuela is criminal. You know, this embargo prevents them from borrowing, so it means they have to pay off debt instead of rolling it over. It means they can't get, sometimes they can't even get loans to import medicines, because the banks and the financial institutions tend to take a very conservative view of these things. They don't want to run into trouble with the U.S. Authorities. And so they are causing food and medicine shortages, which leads to people dying, especially the medicine. The food shortages are not so bad there as the medicine shortages. And it exacerbates the depression and the hyperinflation. So that's significant. I mean, it's true that Obama started that out. You know, he was 2015, he issued the first executive order that put sanctions, but those sanctions were nothing like this. These were sanctions against individuals. And those have an impact too, by the way, much more than the media recognizes. But he didn't do what these guys are doing. So, yeah, I'd like to see him follow that part. I wouldn't like to see him imitate the rest of what the previous two administrations did, because it was terrible. And, yeah, there's no excuse for it.
That was Mark Weisbrot of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington.
The so-called white helmets are hailed as heroes in the U.S. and Britain, but Syrians say the white helmets are actually part of the Al Nusra Front, the Al-Qaeda terrorists in Syria, and are not in the business of rescuing anybody. Vanessa Bailey is a crusading journalist, one of the few Westerners that actually covered the war in Syria. Bailey has done more than any other reporter to expose the helmets as frauds. Now that the Syrian army is closing in on Al-Qaeda and the other Western-backed jihadists in Syria, Israel is lobbying to allow hundreds of jihadists to escape territory or through Jordan, including those claiming to belong to the White Helmets. Vanessa Bealey was interviewed by Phil Taylor on his radio program in Toronto, Canada.
My first question was, when I saw the number of 800 White Helmets, and when we bear in mind that in Eastern Ghouta and in East Aleppo, we had a very similar scenario in which UN agencies were requesting the special evacuation of the White Helmet agents. In Eastern Ghouta, there was a number of 76 White Helmets that was being bandied around by UN agencies, and there was a complaint put in by the permanent representative to the UN in New York for Syria, Dr. Al-Jafri, about the fact that the UN agencies were requesting a special evacuation for the White Helmets with no regard for civilian life. And so, to me, it's not particularly surprising that, as you said, with the closing in of the Syrian Arab Army, the large-scale surrender of the militant forces, who had, of course, also been abandoned by the United States. I mean, the United States, very quickly, when this campaign set out, made the statement that it was not going to come to the aid of the militants that it had been backing in the south. But when I heard that there were 800 White Helmets, I immediately became a little bit suspicious, because although the southern provinces are quite a big area, but as regards actual urban areas, it's not. It's largely open areas. Mm-hmm. So it made no sense to me, in contrast to, for example, Eastern Ghouta, which is a big area, but it's a largely sort of urbanized area, that there would be quite a big number of White Helmets in Eastern Ghouta, but there were only 76. So then for there to be 800 in the southern provinces was a little bit stretching the possibilities. So then when I did this interview with Al Mayadeen, what I found out was that reports on the ground were saying that it was more than the 800 exceptional refugees, let's call them, that had transited into Israel at the behest of the US, the UK, in other words, the regime change coalition. Mm-hmm. There were numbers of around 3,000 that were believed to have been given special treatment by the Israelis to pass into Israel and then, in theory, to be transited to Jordan. But on that basis, we know that only 442 have arrived in Jordan. So the question arises,
did somebody get off the bus? Remaining?
Exactly. So the reports that are coming in are that there were a huge number of Gulf state militants and intelligence that exited via the Israeli border from the UAE, from Qatar, from Saudi Arabia, that there may well have been NATO special forces. Now, again, you know, this isn't some kind of wild conspiracy theory, because we had very similar reports during the evacuations of East Aleppo after the liberation. And, of course, in Eastern Ghouta, we had very similar stories. And we were told, or I was told, by a number of civilians that I interviewed, both in East Aleppo and in Eastern Ghouta, that there were foreign coordinators on the ground who were communicating with their controllers and their handlers in the various countries that were funding the militant groups, but also within the UN. There were foreign coordinators speaking directly to representatives within the UN, according to civilian testimony that I took after the liberation. And they described in great detail exactly who these coordinators were, what groups they worked with, how many there were. And in Eastern Ghouta, for the first time, I heard of there being foreign elements within the White Helmets themselves. We know that over 280 British passport holders left Eastern Ghouta, having been fighting with Nusra Front. They left on the evacuation buses for Idlib. So, you know, while this does seem to be sort of quite a wild theory, it's becoming more and more feasible when you compare it to previous liberations, that there are special forces that were given this special kind of extradition from areas. And of course, Phil, they wouldn't want to get on the buses to go to the north, because, of course, to do that, they would have to go through some sort of inspection of their papers, of their equipment, of their nationality. And the last thing they would want to do, of course, is to expose the number of, let's say, foreign fighters and mercenaries in among, the West loves to call them, the freedom fighters and the rebels in the south. So it would make sense also that Israel, that has been training and offering medical treatment to the militant factions, including ISIS, actually, on the border with Israel, would be doing its utmost to extricate those militants from any potential risk, and also the risk of them giving any evidence or giving any information about Israel's role in the south.
And well, of course, nothing's really official until George Clooney has made a movie about it. So that we can...
Well, in that case, no, it's not official yet, because I think he still seems to be sort of vacillating on that one. But this is another point, Phil, is that Israel, that is perfectly happy and has no conscience over shooting a Palestinian medic in the back or killing children in Gaza, is here offering food and drink to the so-called white helmets and the militants who left with them. I mean, that's a very clear indication of Israel's involvement with this group and with, of course, the entire regime change campaign in Syria. And the very fact that this organization, which claims to be neutral, to be impartial, it has made the extraordinary claim that it saved 150,000 lives.
Yes.
And what is extraordinary, I mean, I'm going to be writing about that this week, but we received a Freedom of Information response finally from the British government. And what this showed us is that the British government has no idea who these lives are that the White Helmets have saved, because they're entirely reliant upon the White Helmets and upon Mayday Rescue, which is the, I won't call it an NGO because it's funded directly by the British government, but an organization, Mayday Rescue, that was set up by James Lemessurier, who established the White Helmets in 2013 and then created Mayday Rescue to act as an intermediary, so an interface between the British government and the White Helmets. But basically what the British government said in its response was that it is entirely reliant upon information fed to it by Mayday Rescue via the White Helmets. So in other words, the White Helmets could make anything up and the British government would take it on as gospel and would then repeat it in its policy documents, which it has done consistently.
Vanessa, that does raise, of course, again, this fact that they are a wholly owned subsidiary, you might call them. They don't, you pointed out, they don't belong to any international humanitarian bodies. One of the things those kind of international bodies do is report to one another and know what they're doing and discuss ways to improve their work. This is entirely a private operation.
Yeah, exactly. And actually what I was going to say is when I interviewed the director of Syrian Arab Red Crescent in Aleppo earlier this year, he directly said to me, he said they were not a humanitarian organization. He said they worked directly with the terrorists and they were entirely reliant upon foreign funding. And he said that foreign funding came in from governments that are trying to destabilize Syria. So that came directly from the director of the Syrian Arab Red Crescent volunteer organization in Aleppo. And that was echoed by members of the Syrian Arab Red Crescent that I spoke to pretty much across Syria. Even actually, I spoke to one volunteer in Hama, and she had been working in Idlib until it became too dangerous. And she said to me, they're a joke. She said, they're not a humanitarian organization. They're actors and they're cinematographers. Yep. She said, that's it. And what they're doing is selling this you know, humanitarian image to the West in order to camouflage the work they're doing with the terrorist groups. Mm-hmm. I mean, Syrians are totally, you know, are now totally informed about who the White Helmets are. And that's another reason that, of course, they have to be evacuated, because were they these selfless saviors of all mankind, they would be being celebrated and being given awards by the families of the civilians they claim to have saved. But I struggle to find, well, I haven't actually yet found one civilian that has any praise of the White Helmets. It is all criticism or actual accusations. I mean, the families who were attacked in Rashdin, the evacuees from Kafra Anfour that were attacked with a suicide bomb that was pre-planned in April 2017. And when I say it was pre-planned, there are recordings of leaders of terrorist groups explaining exactly what they were going to do. And of course, the White Helmets were present then during the attack. And they were responsible, alongside Nusra Front, for the abduction of dead and dying children that were taken from their parents and taken to Turkey. And over 40 of those children are still missing. And so from the Syrian people, who are largely ignored, of course, because mm-hmm. they're the wrong kind of Syrians by Western media, there are a huge number of accusations that have been levied at this group and that are, of course, not being investigated because those narratives are not being documented by the White Helmets. I mean, it's just an extraordinary closed propaganda loop that we're actually seeing.
By the way, your work and the work of former Ambassador Peter Ford, Eva Bartlett, and many others around the world now, sort of on following the work that you have done, more and more are on the scent of what the reality is. But we have a mainstream media that is, they simply want to break this down into camps. So if you bring up that there's no evidence about the 115,000, they refuse to actually deal with the very pointed and factual evidence that you put in front of them. They're really in a mode of trying to smear you and others. Is that true?
I mean, it's quite, I mean, we've been through quite a smear storm for probably the last 12 months. But, you know, what is extraordinary is if you consider the fact that the number of reports fairly recently, there have been about sexual misconduct or conduct by organizations like Oxfam, like Save the Children, like, I believe, the Red Cross. There was also embezzling of funds, et cetera, et cetera, where the media jumped on board and they ran with the story with very sensationalist headlines. But the White Helmets have filmed themselves participating in atrocities committed by Al-Qaeda, Nusra Front, under any manner of sort of rebrand or moniker change. They have been filmed participating in and celebrating executions of civilians, the dismemberment of Syrian Arab army prisoners of war, the torture and public execution of Syrian Arab army prisoners of war. They've been filmed calling for the extermination of the people in Kafraya and Fur, the villages in Idlib that have recently been evacuated. James Lemessurier has himself in an interview admitted in 2015 that they are a sectarian organization. Mm-hmm. They're not impartial. He said it publicly. So for the number of crimes that this group has actually committed, and I include within that, of course, the protectionism that they've given towards terrorist groups that are, of course, being financed either indirectly or directly by the same governments that are funding the White Helmets, this organization has committed a huge number of crimes and has been accused of committing a number of crimes against the Syrian people. But there is not one comment about those from the media organizations, except in defense of the White Helmets or in excuse of those White Helmets committing those crimes. Oh, well, it was a bad apple, or it was just one member of the White Helmets. Mm-hmm. You know, although the archives footage of White Helmets who are still armed militant members of extremist and terrorist groups is quite extraordinary. But of course, all of that has also been ignored. Now, were this to be the Syrian Arab Red Crescent or the Red Cross, we would be seeing outrage and we would be seeing an international demand for an independent inquiry. But it is almost impossible to even get even some of the more sensible journalists within the mainstream sort of apparatus to actually touch the White Helmets. It's almost like they're a completely, as one mainstream journalist said to me in Damascus when I asked them, why were they not prepared to investigate them? They said, oh, well, it's too controversial and it's too polarizing.
it could lead to unemployment.
Yes, exactly.
That was Vanessa Bealey on Phil Taylor's radio program, Unusual Suspects, in Toronto, Canada.
The nation's best-known political prisoner, Mumia Abu-Jamal, has reviewed a book on black communists in Alabama during the Great Depression.
Noted historian and public intellectual Robin D.J. Kelly is brilliant, productive, and talented. But all this could be seen in the beginning of his career, a quarter of a century ago, when the University of North Carolina Press published Hammer and Hoe, Alabama Communists During the Great Depression. By Alabama Communists, Kelly means, for the most part, black Alabamans, workers, miners, agricultural workers, trade unionists, who struggled through the 1930s to build a communist party against the forces of the armed state and fascist right-wing terrorists who beat, shot, assaulted, raped, and murdered people, who tried to unite and fight for better wages and a better way of life. Who knew that there were hundreds, possibly thousands, of black communists organizing in Alabama during the 1930s? Well, Robin D.G. Kelly did. And his book is nothing short of a revelation. This hidden, little-known history of black revolutionaries organizing at a time of fascist reaction in America, and especially Alabama, is what I call underground history. History lived at a high level of resistance, seldom reported, and afterwards all but forgotten, reminds us that black history is often revolutionary history, yet it is rarely acknowledged as such. Kelly's usage of personal interviews with former party members, his study of union newsletters and files of groups active during the Depression, gives us valuable insights into how revolutionary black life was lived during times of arch repression. Sometimes, a book comes along that transforms our thinking of how history is understood. For example, Herbert Apthecker's American Negro Slave Revolts, or C.L.R. James' Black Jacobins on the Haitian Revolution, changed everything that preceded it, as well as all that followed. Robin D.G. Kelly's remarkable work, Hammer and Hoe, originally published in 1990 from Imprisoned Nation. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.